The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Well, it's all go in Washington in the past 24 hours as President Donald Trump loses yet another high-profile staffer in the form of John Bolton, the national security advisor who resigned and yet was also sacked in that Trumpian way. And one man at the media frontline last night, and in recent years indeed, is CNN's Jim Acosta, who has written a book I devoured recently. It's called The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. Jim joins us now. Jim, a very good morning to you.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Are you surprised, Jim, that sales of George Orwell's 1984 have gone through the roof in recent years?
Well, I'm not surprised. We noticed that phenomenon as Trump was coming into office. And listen, I mean, this is a situation we're grappling with here in the U.S. in terms of how to cover this presidency. The Washington Post recently concluded that the president has uttered some 12,000 false or misleading statements since coming into office. I've put this metric in my book, but when my book was published, it was only 10,000 false or misleading statements. So you can see that number is going up at a pretty rapid rate. It raises all sorts of questions. Do we call the president's false statements, falsehoods, lies? In many cases, they are lies. But you hear a lot of critics. You see a lot of critics out there on social media saying every time we should call it a lie. So, you know, this is stuff that we're running up against on a daily basis, just how to cover what is really a strange and surreal presidency at times, especially when it comes to the dishonesty. So I think that's a very fair question.
And again, just keeping with the Orwellian theme just for a moment before we delve into the body of the book and the presidency, in the last 10 days, even sitting with my 20-year-old daughter on the couch saying, you need to watch this. And she, what? I said, look what happened with the Sharpie and Alabama.
Right.
If you put that into a little context for the Irish listeners who might have missed that story, and again, echoing the Orwellian sentiments, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a fascinating example of what we're dealing with. In just the last 10 days, we saw Hurricane Dorian. It was making its way towards the United States. And on Sunday, September 1st, the president put out a tweet saying, you know, watch out, Alabama, it's likely to be hit. But at that point, the National Weather Service was, putting out forecasts showing that the storm was making a right turn and heading up the East Coast. It was not threatening Alabama. And so the president's information was outdated. I don't think he intentionally wanted to say that Alabama was going to be hit. He was just wrong. But in the days that followed, he just didn't want to admit it. And what we saw over the course of the next, 9 or 10 days is the president very likely using a Sharpie to draw on a map to show that the storm was heading towards Alabama. That was a map held up in the Oval Office. And people inside the administration essentially being thrown under the bus. A top Homeland Security advisor put out a statement saying, oh, wait a minute, I was the one who briefed the president before he said that. And then the people at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, put out a statement essentially saying that, you know, the president wasn't that far off. And so, you know, this is a sign of where things are right now with the Trump administration. The president's dishonesty and deception is bleeding down into much of the administration, and you're seeing pressure being put on government officials, people who are supposed to be working on behalf of the taxpayers, to essentially fall in line. And that gets back to 1984, George Orwell. He warned us about all of this, and it puts, you know, journalists in a position of having to not just report the news, but defend the truth.
Which brings us neatly to the very present day, but I want to bounce back to where it all began. And arguably, it all began with what we now call the mainstream media. We're definitely part of it here in this organization. You're definitely part of it in CNN. And the idea that, you know, like the song said, they all laughed when Columbus said he'd find America. They all laughed when Trump said, I'm going to be president. And there was almost a sort of a smugness, maybe an arrogance to it. There was definitely a supercilious feel to it. Laughing the man off the agenda entirely. You know, do you see that now in retrospect, Jim, and sense that there was a miscall?
I think to some extent, yes. And I will say during the campaign, you know, I was starting to take his candidacy very seriously and thinking at the very least he could win the Republican nomination. I was pretty convinced that he was not going to win the presidency based on that Access Hollywood video coming out. I thought that was essentially it for his candidacy. And so did people inside the campaign. You know, there's that moment I talk about with Ryan Priebus, the former RNC chairman, went on to be the White House chief of staff, essentially saying, you know, it's going to take a miracle for us to win. Said that to me right before Election Day. But, you know, yes, I mean, the Democratic Party put out a statement as Trump was getting into the race, mocking his chances. And I think what a lot of the so-called experts in Washington, the conventional wisdom types in Washington, you know, they were essentially caught napping. They did not see what was coming, and that there was this very big populist wave in the making. And I will tell you, I go to these rallies to this day. I wasn't at the one last night. I was at the one in Manchester a couple of weeks ago. The president, despite his problems in the polls right now, still commands a very potent and very, you know, revved up base that wants to get out there in 2020. So anybody who rules, you know, writes him off now, I think, you know, is mistaken.
So when he started to march into the White House, and much to everyone's kind of shock, I suppose, in some ways, he got elected. You covered the Obama administration, and we'd see you on CNN, but we didn't necessarily know you as such. Trump comes along. He's utterly compelling. In fact, so much so that the mainstream media, again, so-called, really broadcast all his rallies, more so than probably others, because it was so engaging and such great showmanship. It was like P.T. Barnum with a rosette. And yet, for all of that, possibly added to his free publicity to get him elected.
I think to some extent, I think that's a valid question. I will say, because I do get this question from time to time, and I like to remind folks, listen, Donald Trump was essentially the GOP frontrunner from the very beginning of this race.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for the mainstream media not to cover the GOP frontrunner as the GOP frontrunner is sort of, you know, asking us not to cover the first place, you know, New England Patriots, asking us to cover them less than the other teams in the league. I mean, that is just not going to happen. But I do think, yes, I think moving forward, you're going to see the coverage change a little bit. You're going to see a lot more fact-checking done. You're not going to see these rallies covered end-to-end live,
right,
as we did in the past. And you're going to see fact-checkers come on after these rallies are over to say, this is what the president got right, this is what the president got wrong. And we at CNN just recently hired a fact-checker named Daniel Dale from the Toronto Star, who's very popular on social media. And he writes up a fact-check that runs after these rallies are over, and is very prominently featured on our website and featured on our programs. And so I think you're going to see the coverage change as a result of what we now know. But as you know, hindsight is always 20/20 with covering politics. But I do think moving forward, the consumer of information also has to be savvier. I mean, something has to be said about, you know, people finding information, finding stories on Facebook, that their Uncle Fred may send to them, coming from very suspicious accounts, very questionable accounts. Mm. You know, people have to understand there are a lot of bad actors out there, people who are not part of the mainstream traditional brand name media, who are in some cases seeking to intentionally mislead the public for the political gain of certain actors out there, foreign and domestic. And so, you know, we all have to be savvier, I think, heading into 2020.
When you challenged the I think it was president-elect that time, It was that story, and you became the story you shared the story, let's say, with the president because of the nature of the exchange. I mean, what happens in the, give us like a sense of that press conference, Jim, if you wouldn't mind, in the sense that, like, do you find yourself frustrated and almost furious, or you know, where are you at when you take on the president? Are you nervous about taking on the commander in chief because he is also so to be respected, and there is that sense that, you know, it's never quite as belligerent, if you like, or certainly as feisty.
Yeah. Well, I describe it as a question of what would you do? And I write about this, you know, throughout my book. But going back to that January 11th, 2017 press conference, you have to remember the president was, you know, taking a story that CNN had reported that the Russians had compromising information on the president-elect. And he was describing that story as fake news. And it was a situation where he was, you know, essentially saying up was down and black was white and real was fake. And I remember just sitting in that, you know, that press conference area right in front of him, just you know, I'm just astounded at what I was hearing and getting pretty angry about it. Because keep in mind, during the campaign, he called us the dishonest media, the disgusting news media. He called us scum and criminals and all sorts of things. And we had, you know, Trump supporters coming up to us in our so-called press cage and screaming traitor in our face and that sort of thing. And so, by the time that press conference came around, I just remember feeling kind of ticked off and thinking to myself, wait a minute, he's not letting me ask a question. He's going after our news organization. I felt like it was incumbent upon me to try to interject and get my question in there. Now, some people may say that wasn't the right call, but looking back, I feel as though I did the right thing and I would do it all over again. I felt that our news organization needed to be defended, but at the same time, he was just not answering the question. And as it turns out, the question that I wanted to ask that day, which is whether or not the president's aides or associates were in contact with the Russians during the campaign, was very much a real news question. And as we found out, as time went on, there were contacts with the Russians, and it became a huge story here in Washington.
And moving to the White House briefing room in November 2018, and again, yeah, another contretemps with the president over the Russian investigation. How do you feel when President Trump is, excuse the word on this, sort of baracking you and hectoring, yeah, you and saying, you know, and then you find yourself fighting back, almost like having a row in a bar. Is that difficult, or is that now just the nature of the job in 2019 or 2018 as it was then?
Well, I think he, you know, as we argued in my press pass case in federal court, he encourages this rough and tumble environment. Sure. And so for the White House people to express, you know, to clutch their pearls and express shock that a reporter would interject and try to interrupt the president when he's berating them is a bit much. And, you know, and I have said that to them privately, like, wait a minute, you know, he's the one that's doing the interrupting, not us. And as a matter of fact, as I put in the book, I try to do this not to bore the reader, but to enlighten the reader. You know, I include some of the transcripts from some of these exchanges. So you can see, yeah, I get about five or six words out of my mouth and he's already interrupting and berating us, you know? So as I said before, it goes back to a question of what would you do? Do you just sit there and take it? Do you let the bully beat you up at the playground? Yeah. Or do you try to get that question out? And if it means talking over the president and, you know, you just try to do it as politely and respectfully as possible, call him sir, call him Mr. President, and so on. But you got to get that question asked, or otherwise, why are you there in the first place? If you're just there to be a potted plant, well, anybody can do that. I feel as though, you know, it's important that these questions be asked. But one of the things that you have to remember about that November 2018 press conference, the thing that really got him upset was I was challenging him on this falsehood that there was a caravan, you know, this caravan of migrants heading towards the border with the U.S. from Central America amounted to an invasion. And remember what just happened in that El Paso mass shooting.
Yes.
The shooter wrote in his manifesto that he wanted to stop a quote-unquote invasion of Mexicans coming into the U.S. So I feel, you know, I defend that question that I asked back then, and I still think it's very important today.
An intern of some description was taking the microphone from you to say, thank you, Jim, you know, you've had your question sort of thing, time to move on. You were accused of saying, standing your ground. That became a kind of a tussle, and then it was a battle to get to the fake news first in some ways.
Well, my feeling about that whole situation was, and listen, you know, people can say, well, you should have handed over the microphone. I understand that. You know, my attitude at that point was, whoa, wait a minute. Why is somebody coming after my microphone? This has never happened to me before. You know, this shouldn't happen. But look what happened after it all ended. You know, they announced that they were taking away my press pass, and then they tried to justify what they were doing with a doctored video. You know, we get called fake news all the time. This was the White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders, tweeting out a doctored video showing me karate chopping this intern, and they removed the audio of me saying, pardon me, ma'am, to try to justify what they were doing. And so, you know, going back to George Orwell, that was the most Orwellian moment I had ever experienced in my career. And so, you know, it almost feels, you know, like we're in a sort of news battleground covering this administration. Yeah. Sometimes they are coming after us in ways that, you know, it could result in the ends of our careers. You know, one of my colleagues, Brian Karam, his press pass was just taken away, and a federal judge had to order the White House to give it back to him. And so, you know, we're up against some circumstances here in the U.S. that we've never seen before. And I think, you know, when you go through them on a daily basis, you can address these questions 10 different ways. But my sense of it is that the best way to take on this administration when they come after our First Amendment rights is to stand our ground. And really anything short of that just invites the administration and future administrations havoc on the First Amendment.
When the president's at those press conferences, I haven't seen him doing it as much of late, but there were times, Jim, when he'd say things like, you know, that's enough, you know, quiet, you know, that sort of thing that a really horrible teacher at school might have said to you in the 50s.
Right.
You know, how I watch you as journalists and kind of one to another from a distance thinking, how is your blood not boiling at being spoken like that in such a demeaning, public, I don't know, spiteful is the right way, but it's just pretty cruel looking.
Well, you have to understand a lot of it is tactical, and, you know, it works. It's very effective with his base, you know, over the weekend, just going into the weekend because of this controversy over the storm, Hurricane Dorian. The president tweeted out a video that showed a CNN logo crashing and burning and being lit on fire. This is the president of the United States doing this sort of thing. And, you know, what we have to recognize is that, you know, he thinks it's tactical, and his political team may think it's tactical to go after the press because it fires up the base. The thing that I write about in my book, and the reason why it's also titled A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America, is that many of the president's supporters don't understand this. They're not in on the act. And that's why, you know, a lot of this hostility, a lot of this rhetoric is absorbed by his base of support. And at times, not all the time, not by everybody, but at times it is directed back at us in ways that make us feel threatened. I've received dozens of death threats. You know, the man who sent the pipe bomb to CNN tweeted death threats at me before he sent that pipe bomb to CNN. And, you know, it was tweeting things that, you know, included some pretty graphic images of violence and so on. And so, you know, what we have to recognize is that this is a very unusual presidency. The president has decided to go after the press in ways that we've never seen before in our lifetime. But that doesn't mean we back down. That doesn't mean that we let that go unchecked. My sense of it is that the only way to deal with it is to make sure they understand that we find it to be unacceptable. And as long as we're doing that in a reasonable, professional way, sure, yes, it's tempting sometimes to lose your cool, but I don't think that's going to serve our cause very well. I think we have to, you know, try to keep things on an even keel and just make sure that the public understands that this is not acceptable.
I was watching your colleague on Reliable Sources on Sunday recently, and he was saying that there hasn't been a daily press briefing at the White House since March the 11th, an extraordinary long time.
Right.
You outlined in your book fascinating exchanges, both verbally and through email and so on, with Sean Spicer and indeed Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Now you have no one to go to, but you do have the president standing for some particularly peculiar and kind of irritating reason beside a helicopter at full tilt waiting to take him off. I mean, right. It kind of adds to the bonkers nature of the world we live in. And, you know, but he gives a lot of access at those, incidentally, but it's just the noise. How are you on that? I mean, are we getting, has the president and the chopper press conference and his constant tweeting replaced essentially the press secretary's role?
It really has. You know, this is by design. The president has decided he doesn't want to see briefings anymore, not by the press secretary. Now, they've replaced that with a lot of, what we call sprays with the president, where we'll go into the Oval Office, we'll be standing by the helicopter as he comes out, Marine One, and he'll take some questions. But as you said, that chopper is roaring, and you can't hear the reporter's questions, you can just hear the president's answers. So you can't hear him evade our questions, you can't hear him tiptoe around what we're trying to get at. That's all by design. And so I don't describe it as access. I describe it as contrived access. It is access in name only, because we don't have those press conferences where the reporter is mic'd, where the reporter is on camera, and you can see and hear the questions. And people may say, oh, that's just because you want to grandstand and get your airtime and so on. Well, no. I mean, people can say that, and that's fine. I suppose they could say that's their opinion. But I think it's just as important for the viewer, for the listener, to see see and hear the questions so they can see whether or not they're being answered. In a lot of these cases with these press briefings, a lot of times it's the way they don't answer the question, it's the way they refuse to answer the question, they avoid the question, that speaks more to what's happening in the world than when they do answer the question. I think sometimes that's even more revealing.
Just as you're talking, I'm just reminded of when the president looked up to the sky and said, "I am the chosen one." And I was kind of shaking my head going, is it possible to move into another realm? And my question to you is this then, in the coverage of it all, are you ever concerned that you and your colleagues in the mainstream media, and I say that quote unquote, are playing into his hands, that you're a gift to him ultimately? You know where I'm going with this, and that his base are fired up by your line of questioning and modus operandi, etc.
Yeah, I've heard that, and I understand that question, and I understand that concern. If somebody could build me a better mousetrap, I'm all ears, believe me. But okay. In the meantime, you know, people will say the same thing about the tweets. Should you cover the tweets? Well, you know, when the President of the United States tweets that members of Congress who happen to be women of color should go back to where they came from, that's news. When he describes Baltimore as a rodent-infested city, that's news. When he describes the chairman of the Fed as an enemy, that's news. I don't know how else to cover that besides to cover it.
The chairman he appointed, incidentally, isn't that it?
The chairman of the Federal Reserve that he appointed, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, when it comes to these questions that we ask, you know, I'm just trying to think of what the world would think of the United States if, you know, all of us in the press corps sounded like a bunch of Stepford wives, you know, saying to the president, "Oh, you're so wonderful, Ms. President," you know, like something out of North Korean state media. My goodness, I think the rest of the world would just look at the United States and gag and wonder what in the world is going on. And so I think the public, I think our friends around the world, they expect the press to hold the president's feet to the fire. It's expected. And I think the moment that stops, you're going to have a lot of people around the world wondering what has happened to the United States. I suspect, you know, that is going to be going on well after Donald Trump has left the scene.
My last question to you, Jim Acosta, this morning is, that you described the erratic nature of President Trump's press conference at the G7 summit to being like a cat chasing a laser pointer. And with that in and with that in mind, do you believe that this cat will chase that laser pointer all the way into a second term or not?
I'm out of the predictions business. Let me put it that way. I didn't think he could win after everything he went through, but he proved a lot of us wrong. The same states that were critical the last time around, keep your eye on this time around. Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, all of those states right now, the president is deep underwater in the polls. He would have to reverse some major trends in order to get a second term. The other thing that he's running up against is an economy that is looking increasingly unsteady. The more the economy looks unsteady, the longer the prospects are for the president. And, you know, Americans, it's a tradition in this country, they vote with their pocketbooks. If there's any sense that this economy is starting to weaken, that is going to make things even more difficult for this president. Typically, when the economy is doing this well, when the unemployment rate is this low, you know, like Ronald Reagan, they're usually cruising into a second term. But George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, you know, he in large part lost due to a recession that was coming to pass here in the U.S. And so we're just going to have to wait and see, I think, how this economy does. But in the meantime, I was proven wrong the last time around. I would say don't count Donald Trump out heading into 2020. You know, one of the things that he has done in this country rather successfully is build a base of support that we really haven't seen, I think, since the 2008 days of Barack Obama. And that is still a potent force to be reckoned with. And I think it gives him the advantage heading into 2020. But there are some major headwinds, no question about it.
Who is the Democrat best place to beat him?
I would just, you know, turn to the polls and say that Joe Biden is probably best positioned. And I wrote about that in my book, that had Joe Biden been the nominee in 2016, I think there's a very strong chance that Joe Biden would be president right now. If there continue to be these questions about gaffes and misstatements and getting a little foggy about, you know, his memory here and there, that has a way of chipping away at a candidate's support over time. It's kind of a death of a thousand cuts.
Sure.
But if Joe Biden can address that, I think he's well positioned to take on Donald Trump and potentially beat him. And we have not had a one-term president since George H.W. Bush. So it's been about, you know, 30 years now. And it seems that the country is due for that statistically, but you know, as I said before, I'm out of the prediction business.
That's for sure. Well, I can understand why it's a messy business. Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you this morning. Really appreciate your insight on all of the above. And congratulations on your book, which will sit up probably beside my copy as of this evening of 1984 by George Orwell as a salutary reminder of the curious nature of the world. Thanks for your
That's
time.
Good company. I'll take it.
You got to take it. Absolutely. Thanks a million, Jim. Nice to talk to you. Appreciate it.
Great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Right.
I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. CNN's Jim Acosta there is the author of The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. It's a super book. I have to say, I enjoyed it from cover to cover. Gobbled it up. If you like American politics, you will not be bored. And you can follow Jim. He's on Twitter at Acosta. All right. That's Jim Acosta. What a fascinating insight into intriguing times. The text number 51551.